The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas V. Gibbs is on the air.
Good evening, everybody. This is Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZ. It's good to see you. Pleasure having you here with me. And we are in Amendment 9 of the U.S. Constitution. I want to talk about what Amendment 9 and 10 is about before we actually read them, because this we're in the Bill of Rights, and these final two amendments are about all other rights not listed, and Amendment 10 is about states' rights. And so there's a couple of questions that come up. You know, first of all, when it comes to all other rights, well, how do we know what a right is? We've had a recent court decision that is challenging the idea that abortion is a right. So how do we figure out, how do we determine what a right is? What is a natural right? We seem to have in our head this idea, things that don't seem to fit the true definition. Let me explain. I think we talked a little bit about this last week and the week before, but I really want to make sure this gets hammered down. Our natural rights follows something called natural law. Natural law is essentially God's law, but not God's moral law per se, but God's law of nature. In the Declaration of Independence, it says the law of nature, the laws of nature and of nature's God. So what is that? And basically, in the world, in the universe, especially for you science geeks out there is a natural order of things. In this natural order, things happen a certain way, and they're consistent because of nature. Nature has it going in that direction. You know, there are certain developmental stages that happen for certain creatures or plants. There are certain orbits that planets follow. There are certain things that happen in physics and quantum physics and all of that. That is the natural order. That's the way it's supposed to go, because that's the way nature has it doing it. And they bring it to a simple form just to help you understand. So let's say we're talking about an orbit. Orbit of our moon, per se. And the orbit of our moon is very important. The orbit of our moon has a certain trajectory it follows. And that orbit not only is good for where the moon is positioned and all of that, but it also influences life here on Earth. Our tides are influenced by it, and there's a certain natural order that goes along with that. The moon didn't decide or not decide whether or not to follow that natural order. The moon does, because the moon exists, because it is in existence by the Creator to follow the natural order of things. Sometimes in nature, there are influencing things, happenings that knock something off of their natural order. So let's say that occurrence in the case of our moon is a comet. It comes by, man, and it smacks the moon good. And it pushes the moon off of its natural trajectory of its orbit. Now that it's no longer following the natural order of things, with what it's supposed to do, there is going to be a consequence. And that consequence is going to be catastrophic, not only for the moon, but for everything around it. That is natural law. Natural law is the natural order of things, and as long as natural law is being followed, things run harmoniously. The moment that we start going off of the beaten path of natural law, either because of something that has impacted it, like a comet, or some other means, then catastrophic things can happen. Consequences happen. Human beings are also subject to the natural order of things. And the natural order of things doesn't change. The natural order of things has been, is, and always will be. And as human beings, we have the ability to reason. The Lord has given us this ability to choose free will. We've heard this. Wonderful thing about free will is we can make some great decisions. We can also make some lousy ones. And when our decisions go off of, in other words, they are not on the same trajectory with the natural order of things, there will be consequences, and these consequences will be negative consequences. Because like the rest of the universe, we also need to follow the natural order of things. That is natural law. So, in our lives, in our trajectory of our from our conception to our birth to our working years to our retirement, there is a natural trajectory, a natural order of things that should be followed, and that is tends to be followed. Of course, every individual is different, and our trajectories are all slightly different depending, but there is a natural order of things that we essentially follow. You know, husband, wife, male, female, procreate, have children, raise those children with values, and then those children forward those values, and so on and so forth. That's all the natural order. When you go outside the natural order, there are consequences. Our rights are a part of that natural order. So if it is in the natural order that we defend ourselves, then we have the right to keep and bear those items that would defend us against the criminal element, against a natural element, against a tyrannical element, whatever it may be. We have that right to defend ourselves with the tools available to us to do so. We have the right to speak our mind, to follow our religious practices, to write what we want to write politically or religiously and have our opinions. We have the right to petition our government for redress of grievances. We have a right to gather together, and birds of a feather tend to flock together. So we're going to gather together in groups that agree with us typically. And there's nothing wrong with that. That is a part of the natural order of things. We have a right to have our homes, to own our possessions, to seek to do better in our lives, to work and take care of ourselves. We have a right to seek education, to pursue owning property. All of those things are part of the natural order. But when you go to things that are outside the natural order and you call that a right, now you're creating things that are going to have negative consequences, like abortion. It is not in the natural order of things to from an unnatural means cease the developmental stage of an unborn child. The natural order of things for that unborn child to follow through its developmental stages and become a part of the society. Sometimes during the progression of life, there are things that happen. Okay, let's get back to now the abortion issue. And let's say someone has a miscarriage. That is a natural interference with the natural order of things. A couple is unable to have children. It's unfortunate. It is a natural situation that interrupts that function. Male and female are supposed to be together for the purpose of procreation. Sometimes in nature, that procreation is not able to happen. But it is unnatural for a couple to couple up that cannot procreate. It is unnatural for a pregnancy to be terminated through artificial means. Those are not within the natural order of things. Therefore, those things would not be rights in the way that the natural order of things would see them as rights. Now, does someone have a right to pursue their happiness? I suppose. And so if they want to chase something that's not a part of the natural order of things, that's fine, but be prepared for the consequences. There's going to be personal and societal consequences to those actions. And rights are not supposed to be treated as something that's guaranteed or protected. It's supposed to be something that we pursue without government interference. So while it may seem like I might have a right to, say, education, it is not government's job to make sure I get that education. That's up to me to pursue it. It's my right to pursue it. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I may not necessarily have a right to health care, but I have a right to pursue it. And government's not supposed to interfere with my ability to pursue it. They're not supposed to make laws so harsh that I can't pursue that health care. And there should be a thriving market that keeps the prices low. There's competition because government did not interfere so that I can pursue that right. You know, I have a right to have a cake make the way I want, and whether it's a natural order style or not. But nonetheless, government's not supposed to make any laws that interfere with me pursuing having that cake baked. But they cannot at the same time tell a baker they have to bake the cake the way I want it. It's for me to pursue it. It's for me to find a baker then that would do such a thing. Government's not supposed to force the issue. They're supposed to get out of the way and allow the culture to take care of it. And if baking a cake in a certain way is not popular, then there probably won't be very many bakers that do it because of our society, culture, allowing culture to take care of it without government influence. And then once again, if there are things going on that are outside the laws of nature in that society, in that culture, it will naturally adjust. There will be consequences. And then that culture will ultimately adjust to the natural order of things. That's what our rights are about. That's what natural law is all about. Now, that all said, we went through the first 8 amendments in the United States Constitution. So we have the First Amendment, which has, you know, religion, speech, press, assembly, petition. Those are all personal rights. Then we have the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. That's a part of that right to defend yourself against nature, against attackers, against lawbreakers, and against tyranny, including your own government. So that's that covered. Third Amendment, you know, your right to not have soldiers quartered in your house. That's your home. You have a right to your home and making the decisions on what happens in your home. Those first three, those are your personal rights. Then 4 through 8, those are your legal rights. So in the Fourth Amendment, we have you have a right to, you know, be secure in your persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, and there has to be a warrant if they are going to search. Amendment 5, you know, has to do with crime and grand juries and you know, double jeopardy. You know, you have a right, once you've been charged and not convicted, you don't have to go through the same thing again. They can't keep hitting you and hitting you and hitting you until they find the right jury that's going to convict you. Can't do that. You can't be compelled to be a witness against yourself, deprived of your life, liberty, or property without due process. Eminent domain's in there. Amendment 6. We have the speedy and public trial. We have the fact that you have a right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against you, to be confronted with the witnesses against you, to have a compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in your favor, to have your assistance of counsel for your defense. Amendment 7, you know, having to do with the small claims court and how, unless it's under a certain amount of money, you know, you still get a jury. Amendment 8, excessive bail, cruel and unusual punishment. So we've talked about all that. Now we're at 9. Amendment 9 says this: the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So it's saying that some of our rights, certain rights, are enumerated or listed in the Constitution in these other amendments. Just because something is not in that enumeration, does that mean that the government can deny or disparage those rights? Those rights are retained by the people, retained by you. You already have those rights. They already belong to you. Retain. Government's not supposed to mess with them. So basically, Amendment 9 is saying, we listed a bunch of rights, we said don't touch it. By the way, if there's a right not listed here, you can't touch that either, government. No laws, no interference, it's none of your business. That is what your rights are all about. And so when people start asking me questions about certain amendments and all that, and shall not be infringed and all that, it's usually from the wrong premise. We have been taught bad premises. I want everybody to understand, this all ties into the natural order of things. Now, then we get to the 10th Amendment, we talk about states' rights. Well, gosh, Doug, how can a state have rights if they're God-given? God didn't go, oh, by the way, states, you get rights. Well, the states' rights are our rights through our state. It's human rights, it's rights as individuals through our collection or our collective of being a state. That's what it's really about. And when it comes to the states, as a people, as a group that makes up a state, we do have certain rights. We do have a right to be able to do things through our state. In other words, localism, local government, that we don't want the federal government to mess with. As a state government, us people have the local right for local laws. And it's for us to determine what we do regarding those local things, and the federal government has no business being involved in those things. And that's what the 10th Amendment's all about. So the 10th Amendment says the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. So in other words, there are powers of the Constitution, they're delegated or they're not delegated. If they're delegated to the federal government, it's an authority. If they're not delegated, it's not an authority, nor prohibited by it to the states. So there is a section, Article 1, Section 10, says, oh, by the way, states, you can't do this, you can't do that. So what it's saying in the 10th Amendment is if the power is not given to the federal government and the power is not told, and it's not in the Constitution to tell the states they are prohibited from it, if neither one of those things exist, in other words, it's not in the Constitution, it's not a power given to the federal government, it's not prohibited to the states, then those powers are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Because the states had all the power beforehand. So if it's not delegated to the federal government, the states are not told that it's prohibited to them, it's a state issue, no matter what it is. Even if it didn't exist at the time of the writing of the Constitution. We didn't fly in airplanes at the time of the Constitution. So since the aviation is not given to the federal government in the Constitution, it's not prohibited to states, then aviation should be a state issue. Oh my gosh, Doug, are you saying the state should control all this international travel and everything? Not necessarily, but there should be an amendment giving the federal government that authority. They're not supposed to take an authority without the amendment. Otherwise, it's a state issue. So we need to do some fixing there, don't we? So the 10th Amendment, now, because it's the enumeration, it has to do with the enumeration doctrine, this idea that authorities are enumerated to the federal government, it becomes a very important amendment. Now, let's look at this from the point of view of the Founding Fathers, why don't we, at the time that this was being written. Remember, the delegates in the Constitutional Convention, well, they were representing we the people. They're more specifically representing the states. The states, through these delegates, was creating a federal government to handle the powers that the states could not handle individually. For example, if you wanted to have a treaty negotiated, you're not going to send 50 negotiators. You're going to send one guy to represent all the negotiators, the president. But because we don't trust this federal government, while the president can sign the treaty, negotiate the treaty, and bring the treaty back home, it does not go into effect until the Senate ratifies it. And back then, remember, the senators were appointed by the state legislatures. So therefore, it was an oversight mechanism for the states to have over the president, over the negotiator. So they wanted to create a federal government to go handle those things they couldn't handle, but they still were going to have mechanisms in place to approve it. So while the federal government would do the things that the federal government was given, it would still have to be approved by the states who were creating the federal government in the first place. And so in this amendment, it's saying, hey, we're giving you some authorities, federal government. We're giving you powers, and we want you to handle these powers. But remember, we're still going to need to approve it. So we're going to let you spend money and raise money and spend federal funding, but whenever you need your budget, you have to get it approved from us because we're the ones that's giving you the money. So the states were paying the tax, and the states would determine whether or not to pay it. But, you know, what if the federal government says, well, hey, we want to, you know, we want to have new judges on the Supreme Court. You know, this guy's gone. This guy, you know, has resigned or died or something. He's retiring. We want a new Supreme Court judge. No problem. Nominate your guy. But through the Senate, we're going to confirm that that nomination. We're still going to make doubly sure. So, well, gosh, you know, states, federal government says, we want new powers, we want new authorities. And the states say, fine, propose an amendment, but still going to take 3/4 of the states to ratify it. We still need to approve it. The federal government says, well, gosh, you know, it's time for a new president, and we need a new executive officer to lead the federal government. And the states say, fine, run your guys, run your campaigns, put your guys forward. But in the end, it's going to be electors appointed by the states that are going to do the approving process, the voting process. You don't get your new person because you choose them, we will. So there's this situation going on where the states are basically acting as oversight over the federal government because they created it. They created this monster. They want to make sure it remains in tune with what they want. Now, that pretty much concludes the Bill of Rights, but this theme of the states saying, hey, we're not going to let the federal government get too big for its britches. We're going to not let it go more than beyond, you know, get too much, be too much for its own good, that kind of thing, theme, continues with the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment was ratified in 1795. In 1793, there was a case, Chisholm v. Georgia, and it was regarding contracts between a clothing maker and people from another state, from I think it was South Carolina, and disagreement. So Georgia got sued, and Georgia said, hey, this is a state issue, and the federal court's got no business taking this this case. And the federal court said, you know what, Georgia, in this case, I don't care if you think it's a state issue. You've got no state sovereignty. You're going to do what we tell you. And Georgia's like, forget you. And the states are watching this going, whoa, the federal courts are overstepping their bounds. They are dictating to a state like that. It's up to the state what it does on these things. And so to stop that from happening in the future, they actually took power away from the courts. So here's what it says in the 11th Amendment. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. So the states cannot be sued at the federal level by citizens of another state or by persons of a foreign state. It does not say they cannot be sued. That case cannot go to the federal government, the federal courts. So let's say, for example, remember way back when Arizona had its immigration law, and it was basically written the same way as the federal law was, except for it didn't allow profiling. That was the only difference. And then it was by the state that did that. And so let's say Larassa from Los Angeles could not sue the state of Arizona for that for that law. Or some group out of Mexico could not sue the state of Arizona. Well, they could. Let's back up. They could sue, but it could not go to the federal courts. The highest it could go would be the state Supreme Court. So let's now get back to, well, the federal government wound up suing Arizona over that. Remember that? Eric Holder had filed a case, but he filed it in the district court. Now, that was an illegal filing because the district court is a federal court. The federal courts had no business taking the case because Arizona was a party to the case. Unfortunately, the government there in Arizona did not recognize the problem and treated it as any normal case. And once it goes in play, the argument's lost. So Eric Holder actually filed it illegally. It should have been filed in a state court, and the highest it could have gotten was a state Supreme Court. And that's not what happened. Now, either Eric Holder knew he was breaking the Constitution and didn't care, or didn't know. Well, most people think he knew, and he just did it anyway. So, that's the 11th Amendment, and the idea was to stop the courts from interfering with state issues when it came to the state's debate with persons outside the state. It's none of the federal government's business. Of course, through judicial interpretation and stuff, they've annotated that to mean something different now, and sometimes those cases do get to the federal courts, unfortunately. All right, let's take a break. Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about the 12th Amendment. 12th Amendment will take up the remainder of our time today, and then that means next week we'll get into 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which have to do with the war between the states. So 12th Amendment, after this break, don't go anywhere. Creator by Douglas V. Gibbs is on sale now. His 8th book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses 7 critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation, a cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' belief in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store. Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Radical, powerful, enlightening. The journey of America is a tale that needs to be heard, and Mr. Constitution tells it each week on the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, Saturdays at 9 p.m. Pacific on K-Praise, San Diego's Salem Media radio station for Christian programming, FM 106.1 in North County, AM 1210 in San Diego, and online for the world at kprz.com. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, welcome back. Shorter break than usual, but we got a lot to talk about. I wanted to give us enough time. 12th Amendment reads, "The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots the person voted for as vice president." Now, we've heard just recently, for example, that Trump and DeSantis cannot run on the same ticket because it says in the Constitution two people from the same state cannot run for office. That's not what it says. What it says is that the electors cannot vote for more than one inhabitant of the same state with themselves. So in other words, if both Trump and DeSantis were to run on a ticket, say Trump for president, DeSantis, who is governor of Florida, as vice president, then that means they couldn't receive the electoral votes from Florida. All the other electoral votes they could. Now that would probably kill the chance anyway, because Florida is usually the deciding state. But Wood does not say that a president, vice president from the same state cannot run for president. It says that if they do, they will not receive the electoral votes from the state they are both from, because the elector cannot vote for both president and vice president. They can only vote for one of them. Now, then what it says is that their names shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots the person voted for vice president. The presidential election and the vice presidential election are supposed to be two distinct elections. When we get our ballots, it said, the last one, it said, you know, Trump/Pence, Biden/Harris. That's unconstitutional. They're not supposed to be on the same ballot. They're supposed to be two distinct ballots. And it's supposed to be two distinct ballots for the electors. The people aren't even supposed to be voting. The electors are supposed to vote for president. Now, I just created some confusion. Let's fix that. The federal government was not created to get involved in your life. The federal government is not supposed to be there to interfere with the daily lives of the people who live in the states. The federal government's job is not the internal order of the United States. That is the job of each state, to handle their own internal order. The job of the federal government is not to get involved internally, domestically. It is to take care of the external things, or the things that have to do with preserving, promoting, or protecting the union. So common defense, the border there between us and other countries, maritime law, trade with other countries, and things like that. Disputes between the states would be in there. Communication between the states. That's the reason why the federal government has the authority to establish post offices. All of that has to do with the union. But beyond that, it's none of the federal government's business. If that's the case, then whose president is the president, really? If the president's job is limited to what the federal government can do and the laws that can be made regarding external issues, then why would the people vote for the president if he's not really their president? He's the president of the union. And it is the union that he's supposed to take care of so that the states can take care of the domestic issues. If that's the case, then who should vote for president? The union. And the union are the states, the state legislatures. So they appointed the electors, and then the electors vote for president. Then they appoint the same electors, and those electors on a separate ballot vote for vice president. That's the way it's supposed to be. So the electors shall meet in their prospective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots the person voted for as vice president. And they shall make distinct lists of all persons voted for as president, and of all persons voted for as vice president, and of the number of votes for each, which lists they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of the government of the United States, directed to the president of the Senate. Notice that is the only place in the Constitution that the word certify shows up. The electors certify the electoral votes. Now, the word decertify is not in the Constitution. So now I'm going all the way back to when Vice President Pence, as president to the Senate, was there to count the electoral votes. Now, a lot of people got all over Pence because he should have rejected the votes, sent them back to the states because of the alleged fraud that had happened. And I do believe there was fraud. I do believe those electoral votes were messed up. But it wasn't the vice president's job to send it back. He does not decertify them. He does not certify them. The certification of those votes is the electors. The electors are supposed to be appointed by the state legislatures, which they're not today. They're now appointed by the parties. So we have all kinds of problems here. Our fraud that we believe happened wouldn't have happened had we been following the original techniques for voting for president, the original plan, the original model, the original framework for electing our president of the United States and vice president. And so it goes to the vice president, and he's there to count the votes, and that's it. Okay, so getting back to now, the word certify, the votes, the electoral votes are certified by the electors who decertifies if there is a problem. Well, the word decertify is not the Constitution. That does not mean that the founders didn't think of who it would be. They were leaving it to the states. Remember, 10th Amendment. If something is not given to the federal government and it's not prohibited to the states, it belongs to the states. So the state legislatures have the job of decertifying if there's a problem. But yet, when these states have tried to legally, through litigation, remember the Texas case, the federal government shot it down. Who's the federal government to shoot it down? They don't have authority. Their job over the election does not include certification or decertification. They have no authority over that. As up to each of the states. Now, it says after that in this 12th Amendment that the president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates and the votes shall then be counted. Notice it doesn't say anything about decertification. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president, if such be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. Remember, 270 to win has to be that majority, whatever that number is, or more. And if no person have such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding three on the list, so the top three electoral votes getters of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. So if the Electoral College does not get a majority and the person is not chosen by the Electoral College once the electoral votes are counted, it goes to the House of Representatives. That has happened a number of times. Jefferson was elected by the House of Representatives. Andrew Jackson was elected by the House of Representatives. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. So it's per state. So it doesn't matter that California has more members in the House than, say, Rhode Island. Each state gets one vote when it comes to voting for president. A quorum for this purpose shall be consist of a member or members from two-thirds of the states. So it's not based on the number of people, it's based on the number of states represented. And if two-thirds of the states are represented by people, even if they don't have all their people, then there's a quorum. And a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice. So when it goes to the House of Representatives, you must win most of the states. It must be a majority. So in other words, once again, you got three candidates and one gets more votes than the other. But if it's not a majority, they don't win the presidency. Now, the next part is in brackets. It says, and if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president, whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them before the fourth day of March next following, then the vice president shall act as president in the case of the death of or other constitutional disability of the president. That date has been changed from March to January 20th. Then it says the person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be the vice president, if such number be a majority. Remember, there are separate ballots. If such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, just like the president, there has to be a majority. So if you've got a number of candidates, and one person wins, but it's not a majority of the overall votes, then they don't get the office. And if no party shall have majority, then from the two highest numbers on the list, the Senate shall choose the president. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of two-thirds of the whole number of senators. So this is unlike the House. Remember, it was two-thirds of the states represented. Here you have two per state, so it has to do with the Senate itself. And then it says a majority of the whole number shall be necessary to a choice. So in other words, you can have a state splitting votes on this one. It isn't by state, it's by senator. But no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible that of vice president of the United States. They had to add that because prior to the 20th Amendment, or 12th Amendment, I mean, the presidential election was conducted in a different manner. It was a bunch of people running for president. The winner was president. The second place winner was vice president. So the vice president was eligible for president because in order to run for president, they had to be eligible for president. And that's what they ran for originally. Now that you have two separate ballots, they wanted to make sure it was understood that the vice president still needed to be eligible for president. They had to meet the eligibility requirements. And so it says that the that the president, no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible that of vice president of the United States, because it's a separate election. That means the vice president, well, you know, remember, the vice president's one heartbeat away or one bullet away or whatever you want to call it, away from the presidency anyway. So they do need to be eligible. When it comes to Kamala Harris, I have a lawsuit through the Constitution Association, constitutionassociation.com, if you want to read it, that basically sues her because she's not eligible. In order to be eligible, you got to be, for the presidency, you got to be at least 35, a resident of the United States at least 14 years, and you have to be a natural-born citizen. Natural-born citizen being a step up from citizen. And the citizenship clause and all of that jazz. We have been taught that birthright citizenship is enough for both citizenship and natural-born citizen, and birthright citizen just doesn't exist, not the way the not in the Constitution, the way it's being presented. Natural-born citizen, once again, is a step up from citizen. The definition is that both parents were citizens at the time of the birth of the child. So now we ask about President Barack Obama. So, well, he was born in Hawaii. By his own admission, both of his parents weren't citizens at the time of his birth, so really he actually wasn't eligible. In the case of Kamala Harris, while she was born in Oakland, her parents were here on student visas. Her parents were not citizens. And you can even be a naturalized citizen, as long as you're a citizen. In her case, they were both here on student visas. They were visitors. They weren't even showing any intention of staying here permanently. So there's even questions regarding her citizenship, much less natural-born citizenship. So she's not eligible. A lawsuit by the Constitution Association was launched on December 7th, 2020, regarding this. And right now that case is in the Ninth Circuit. We filed it in the district court. It is in, we appealed to the Ninth Circuit tail end of last year. But now someone says, well, she was born in Oakland. That's good enough. No, that's not good enough. That's birthright citizenship thinking. And that is present in our system. If you were born on American soil, you were naturally born there, therefore you're natural born. Stop what the founding fathers meant. Once again, you go back to a resource. Vattel's Law of Nations was the resource they used. Vattel's Law of Nations was on the floor, the Constitutional Convention, three copies. George Washington brought one, and Ben Franklin brought two copies. So in the case of Ben Franklin, he brought an English copy and a French copy. And that was the resource they used for legal definitions at the time. There's also a reference to that definition being the definition in the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1790. And we have five cases of dicta by Supreme Court justices that use that definition in cases that they rule upon. So we have all kinds of evidence showing that that is the case. And vice president must meet those same requirements. That's just the way it is. Now, if we get a question of, well, what happens if she's removed, or what if happens, you know, how can we get rid of her? There's all kinds of those, and we just don't have the time today to go over those. Now, we're talking about this topic from a biblical perspective. When you go to the Bible and you look up citizenship, it talks about citizenship in heaven, you know, citizenship as a Christian, that you are a citizen of heaven, things like that. But one verse I do like to tie into this that kind of helps us understand, because remember, the reason for a natural-born citizen to be present, the reason why you want people to reside in the United States, to be citizens to vote, to be citizens to hold office, and all that jazz, is because we want to make sure that there's no foreign influence, that there is no divided allegiances. And 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 kind of talks about that. And I know that technically it is talking about a different connection, a different coupling, but it really ties into this as well. 2 Corinthians 6:14, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness? So when you take something that is good, like the American system, that is a godly thing, and you put foreign influence into it, it's unequally yoked. It's not properly yoked, and you're going to have problems. There's going to be disputes. There's going to be consequences that are not to our liking. So we need to make sure that we don't have people who don't believe in our system and don't believe in our God as leaders of our country. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And so that's why a natural-born citizen having two parents citizens at the time of one's birth is important. You are purely an American. You purely believe in the system. You are purely loyal to the system, or at least typically you would be if you are a natural-born citizen. If we've got people who have foreign influences, they've got parents from other places, or they spent many years studying abroad, and they haven't been a resident of the United States for so many years, or whatever, that could cause problems, because then they'll have foreign ideas and foreign influences in their decision-making. And our system is based on what the Constitution says, not what the world says. The point of the U.S. Constitution and the point of the United States, exceptionalism, meaning the exception to the rule, it means that we're different. We are not them. We do not have the world's system in our system. Ours is not of the world. It is the United States. It is of liberty. It is of God. It is dictated by this Constitution, not by some foreign court or some foreign idea. That is the purpose. And you'll notice throughout the Constitution, there's a number of mechanisms that are designed to protect allegiance, to make sure that there is no divided loyalty in the system, that this is all about America. Make America great, make America first, whatever. That's what it was about. It was about doing American things in an American system with American ideas. We don't want the foreign influence. We don't want foreign people holding office. We don't want people with foreign influence and foreign ideas holding office. So therefore, you need to be a resident of the country for so long. You need to be a citizen. And in the case of president and vice president, you need to be a natural-born citizen, meaning both parents citizens at the time of your birth. Loyalty was huge. You did not want foreign influence in our system. Okay. So that's the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th Amendment that we went over today. I'm glad that you spent the time with me. When we come back next week, I'm going to talk about the war between the states. I notice I don't call it the American Civil War. It wasn't a civil war. In a civil war, you have pieces of a whole fighting for control of that whole. This was not a fight for control of the whole. The Confederate states had removed themselves from the contract. They were no longer a part of the whole. They were Confederate states outside the system. They had separated themselves from the whole. They were the Confederate States of America. They were a different country. So the war between the states was a war between the Confederate states and the Union states, two different countries, not a civil war. And we're told that the primary reason for the war between the states was slavery. Not necessarily. First of all, it was about, from Lincoln's point of view, about reuniting the Union, holding the Union together, forcing those states back into the Union through military occupation and military threat. The reason for the secession by those states was because they felt that the federal government was not doing its job, that the Constitution was being violated, it was being breached. In fact, the first sentence of the Confederate Constitution says such, that they're leaving because the Constitution had been breached, and they felt that they could not be a part of a system in which one party was willing to violate the Constitution in such a way. So you have a breaching of the Constitution, so one group says, we're out of here. It's almost like a bad divorce. One side says, we want out of here, and the other side says, no, you can't leave, and we're going to beat you to keep you. Not that I'm trying to promote or protect or preserve the idea of slavery. It's a bad thing. I'm not in any way condoning it, but what the Southern states did from a non-slavery, just looking at the other facts basis, point of view, what they did was not only okay, but expected. If the contract's going to be violated, you want out of the contract. And that's what they did. Whether or not their reasoning or the reason behind it was slavery was moral or consistent when liberty is not the point. They felt the contract had been violated, and the northern states basically said, nah, you can't leave, and we're going to force you back in with military attack, military occupation, and military control. That is really what happened. I'm going to get into that next week. We're going to get into the story behind the war between the states, and we're going to get into what the three amendments, you know, the Reconstruction period, were about, the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment. And remember, there was a missing 13th Amendment. The original 13th Amendment was discovered in 1983, and it was ratified in 1811. And much of the original ratification articles were destroyed in 1814 when, during the War of 1812, the British set aflame the White House, Library of Congress, and all the other federal buildings in Washington, D.C. due to the loss of the documents. In 1819, the state of Virginia issued an official government booklet declaring its original ratification of this now missing amendment. The original 13th Amendment vanished from the U.S. Constitution during the war between the states from 1861 to 1865. The text reads, "If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them. Membership to the International Bar Association, as a result, was forbidden." This missing 13th Amendment showed up in a number of publications. A friend of mine owns one of them, a book of military laws, which was published by the United States government. It has that original 13th Amendment in it. I took pictures of the pages. I don't have a book currently with that 13th Amendment, but I have taken pictures of that book, its pages. And that's what we're up against. That's what we're seeing in history, is that even way back then, we were trying to be apart from Europe, and they were trying to force us back in. And that's a great example. So that we also talk about next week. So we've got 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, the missing 13th Amendment, the Reconstruction period, the war between the states, all of that next week. So we'll see you then. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, and my friends, God bless you. Thanks for listening to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise. We'll be here next week, same time. See you then.
J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.